KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. On Sunday, Bay Area psychologist Madeline Levine penned an op-ed piece for the New York Times called Raising Successful Children. You could almost feel all those anxious parental eyes giving it a quick scan all across the country. And sure enough, the column has been among the most emailed articles on the Times website for the last 2 days. But if you read the story, you know that Levine believes our notion of children's success is a failure. Levine's new book is called Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. We'll talk with Madeline Levine about how she defines success, what it means for children and for parents, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in This Morning for Michael Krasny. A young Stanford undergrad is walking across campus when she suddenly realizes she's left her schedule back in the dorm and isn't sure where her next class is. So does she A, ask a nearby student where that class might be, B, call the department on her cell phone and check, or C, call her mom? The answer is she calls her mom. Psychologist Madeline Levine describes that story in her new book, Teach Your Children Well. Levine believes that while parents tend to do anything and sacrifice everything to further their children's academic success, they don't do nearly enough to foster what she calls authentic success. Success typified not by grades and college acceptance letters, but by things like resourcefulness and well-being. Why she thinks it's crucial that American parents focus on the latter and how you go about doing it is the subject of her book and our conversation this morning. The book is Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. Madeline Levine is a psychologist based in Marin. She's also the co-founder of Challenge Success, a project that started at the School of Education at Stanford University. Her previous books include The Price of Privilege. Madeline Levine, good morning.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for being here. So I love that story about what it may say about sort of what we focus on and what we don't. How did you come to want to drill down on this particular area, which has gotten so much attention now, just in the last 48 hours since your op-ed piece appeared in the New York Times?
Right. So I think that when you drill down is right. So I had written The Price of Privilege 6 years ago. It was supposed to be a tiny book because it was about privileged kids. I think it had an initial run of 12,000 copies, ended up on the New York Times bestseller list. So that suggested it was more than just privileged kids. And as I went around the country to public schools and private schools and affluent communities and middle class, working class communities, the issue was the same. I was asked the same questions over and over. You know, my kid's exhausted. What do I do? They're spending too much time with technology. What do I do? They want to take 5 AP classes, what do I do? How do I get them into Stanford, which was sort of the major question. And it seemed to me that until we really understood what was going on, because I was seeing the other end of it, I was seeing the kids who, in spite of all this oversight, were doing poorly. Price of Privilege opens with a very affluent girl who looks great, but she has carved the word empty into her arm with a razor. And it seemed to me that the whole issue of parenting and parent development and how we parent well was not fully explored.
Is it as simple as saying that we've just gotten it all out of whack in terms of what we think is important?
I'd say that's a nice, that's a nice synthesis of what I'm saying. I think we have shifted way too far in one direction. And I want to be really clear that I'm not anti-intellectual. I'm not bring down standards, let your kid do whatever. That's not it at all. You know, I'm a Jewish PhD from New York, and my husband's what my family likes to call a real doctor. So it's not an anti-intellectual family. My goal is to have kids actually reach their potential. And I think that we're going about it all wrong and that we have myths about what it takes to reach potential that are just totally off.
So let's talk about what some of those myths are. Are they that we equate success with things like what school you get into? Give us kind of the ingredients of the what you think of as the wrong definition of success.
Right, the mythology around success. So we start very, very young. I saw an article in The Atlantic called The Data-Driven Parent, which was the scariest thing I've ever seen. It was about how there's a new phone app so that you can monitor, they call it IO input-output, every ounce your child takes, every move they make, every time they whimper, you know, their output, as they call it, from day one. So this idea that kids need constant oversight to develop is very scary to me. One, because it's lousy for child development, but two, as the mother of three sons, I was exhausted when they were babies, let alone having to look at a ticker tape of every move they made. So one of the myths is that kids need constant oversight, and in fact, they don't. I mean, children, for the most part, develop naturally. Do they need certain conditions to thrive? Yes, but those conditions are things like consistency, availability, non-interference, actually. So that's one myth. Another myth I think we have is earlier is better, when in fact, in terms of child development, earlier often is not better. So we have Baby Einstein, which was in every third household in America, labeled as an educational, give your kid a leg up kind of thing.
Your basic advice when you come to that topic in your book is something like educational toys, don't.
Right. Especially if it has the word Einstein or Beethoven or Picasso. And, you know, this notion that somehow your child is going to be an Einstein or a Picasso or a Beethoven is not in line with reality. Those were extraordinary people. Einstein actually was a very late talker. So why they would label something to accelerate language as Einstein was interesting. But in fact, what they found out was that it retarded language acquisition by 10%. And it took decades for Disney to come out and apologize and give you your money back and take the word educational off, because their resources were so much greater than the Department of Psychology at Washington that conducted the interviews.
So I want to get to what we know about how children can be cultivated best. But before we get to that, where does that come from, do you think? Where is it that parents have become so uber-focused on wanting to develop and measure and oversee and correct and encourage in every possible way?
So you and I talked a little bit before the show about when I think this took place. You know, when did this shift happen? Because your parents, I don't know your parents, so let me speak for myself. My parents certainly did not pay attention to my daily academic achievement. You know, now when my kids went to school, every grade was on the internet. They called it Power School. I called it Power Snoop, because, you know, it's seductive to see, did your kid turn in their homework every day? But it just adds to this tremendous anxiety. So I think somewhere in the 80s, when there was the huge technology bubble and anybody could become a millionaire overnight, you know, whether it was your stockbroker or your florist, the world became flatter and there was competition. And so we started really worrying about whether or not our kids would have a place in that world. A lot of moms went back to work without really any institutional support. So a lot of us felt sort of guilty and tried to make up for it by being uber present, as you said. And the media shifted. We had a 24-hour news cycle at that point, which was constantly drawing attention to everything that was problematic. So the kinds of things that used to be just normal daily life, you know, I'd come home and say I had a fight with my girlfriend and my mom would say, figure it out. That was it. Now you've got 24 hours of psychologists and child professionals and all kinds of people saying, you know, you really need to pay attention to this. And I think there's something called mean world syndrome, you know, which means the more you are involved with the media, the scarier the world is, the more you have to buckle down and make sure your family is protected. So I think all those things came together at a point, sort of a perfect storm, and made parents very anxious about their kids. And also, Dave, you know, we're the parents of the 60s, the tail end of the baby boomers. And we thought we were awful special for a long time.
So does that mean that to start kind of some kind of corrective measure in terms of what you encourage in kids, that the first thing you have to do is not so much look at your kids, but look at you?
Absolutely. It's totally like between the lines of everything in Teach Your Children Well is this is really about you. It's really about why it's so critically important. It's really about why your child has become almost like an accessory that sometimes I have this image of we've all become decorators as opposed to construction workers, and that what kids really need is not, you know, the right curtains, i.e. the right schools and the right grades, but they need a strong foundation. And so many parents are busy paying attention to the decorative aspect of their child.
So in specific terms, does that mean spending less time at the soccer match and less time worrying about grades and more time that is invested in what? Is it in talking about doing good deeds? Is it in values? Is it in exploration? What's the where we ought to go that we're not going?
Those are all really good ideas. I think getting to know your child is a quiet and long process. And sometimes people will ask me, did I really have dinner 5 nights a week with my children? Because we know having dinner with your kids is a good idea. And it was like, you know, it wasn't like brilliant, deep conversation with 3 boys every night about how they felt about things, not by a long shot. Occasionally it was. Occasionally it was political. Occasionally it was about their work. Occasionally it was about what my husband right now is in Guatemala. He does third world medicine every year or so. So I think it matters less what the focus is and more on the idea that we actually set aside some time every day for what at Challenge Success we call PDF, playtime, downtime, family time. That it's in that quiet space that you actually get to know who your child is. And that's your primary job as a parent.
And when you engage in that process of getting to know who your child is, does that then inform what you call authentic success is? Because it's specific, it's defined by who that child is?
Right. So I don't love the word authentic, but I couldn't come up with a better one. And I think it does capture what I'm talking about. Authentic success is as differentiated, somebody said to me yesterday, like from what? Well, from inauthentic, because so many of these kids can look good and really be suffering underneath and not feel that they have a place to come home to internally. But I think the idea behind authentic has a lot to do with whether or not things are coming from inside of you or outside of you. So you may tell your child a million times, you're so smart, you're so great, you're so whatever. And it doesn't mean anything unless the kid feels that way internally. So I think if we shift from performance, which is what grade did you get, to real curiosity about learning and how the child experiences things, so that would be, did you learn anything new on the test, or, you know, what was the test like for you? We shift it from the external evaluation. You got an A, oh, you're so smart. You got a C, you know, you're such a slacker. We change from external evaluation to encouraging children to go inside and evaluate for themselves. And at the end of the day, that's what I think authentic means. It's internal. It's your definition of what's successful. I don't, as you know from the book, I don't tell people what success is. It's different for everybody, but it has to be crafted internally.
I want to ask you about the word self-esteem and how that ties into success, because I hear so often in conversations with parents this question of, I want my kid to have good self-esteem. You seem to feel from the book this sense that we maybe worry about that too much, or that we try too hard by telling all of our kids, you're so smart, you're so great, and that in the end really doesn't create what we want.
Right. That's exactly right. I mean, actually, self-esteem is a great thing to have. And in psychology, real self-esteem, and I'll say what I think that is in a minute, is tied to everything from lower pregnancy rates to better academic performance to better social skills. So real self-esteem is a big advantage. We seem to be under the impression that you can graft self-esteem onto your children if you just tell them enough how special they are. The reality is that self-esteem comes out of competence. How do you get confident about something? You get better at it. And Carol Dweck has done these really interesting experiments where she gives kids a puzzle and then she tells one group that they're really, really smart and she tells the other group nothing and lets them go at more and more difficult puzzles. And it's the group that hasn't been told anything that does better, that makes more mistakes, that tries harder, and that ultimately becomes much better puzzle takers.
This was done at Stanford, right, the study?
Yes.
Carol Dweck.
Yeah.
So are you saying then that there is a burden that's placed on kids when we say, you're so smart, that creates in them a certain kind of anxiety about who they ought to be?
Right. I think, the way I think about it is the risk for the child then becomes really great. If I've just sat here and told you, you're the absolute best at interviewing, and then you have the pressure of my evaluation or vice versa, right? So you tell a kid this, how can they afford to take risks? And risk-taking is incredibly important going forward. How can they afford to take a risk if they're going to lose your feeling that they're doing well? I mean, kids really depend on their parents. Even when they're eye-rolling teenagers, it still matters what you think of them.
What about, then, the importance of risk, which inherent in that is the possibility that you'll screw up and make mistakes? That seems so hard, I think, for any parent to allow your kid, essentially, the possibility to fail. Why is that important, and how do you work with parents to give them that ability to let their kids fail?
I think it's one of the most critical things we can do. And I think if you keep in mind the image of a toddler who takes a couple of steps, falls down on her butt, right? Takes a couple more steps, falls down. We don't get hysterical. We cheer her on. Come on, get up. You can do it. That's the model, I think, in life for how kids master things. So if we swooped in at the first stumble, that child wouldn't learn how to walk. She walks because she fails over and over and over again with our continued encouragement and presence. And I think the exact same thing is true throughout life, that unless, I'm sitting here because you have my book on the table, and it's like if you had seen the first iteration of that book, I mean, it was not the book that's sitting at the table. So it had a, like anything you get to do well, you have to do it over and over again. Is it hard for parents? Yes, but it's hard for them out of their own needs more than out of the child's.
But also, isn't it fair to say that there's, well, let's talk about this, because I think a lot of parents would say, hey, it's a scary world. There's a lot out there to be afraid of, and the stakes are high, and competition is tough, and the economy sucks, and all the rest. So
right.
I've got to do everything I can so that my child has a chance.
And so in being overly involved, actually, you're limiting your child's chances to thrive in that very difficult world. So you get no argument from me. I have three kids who are going out in the world right now about what a difficult time it is. So more than ever, it means that kids need to be resilient and resourceful and know how to pick themselves up when they have trouble. And if you keep let's take just a really simple example, right? So your child leaves their homework on the kitchen table, your 10-year-old, and most parents feel compelled to go bring it up to school because they might get a zero. And if they get a zero, it might lower their grade. What's the problem with that? Well, the problem is that once again, just like the girl from Stanford, who, by the way, had her schedule in her backpack. So it was 3 inches away from her. And she called 3,000 miles away to Boston. You have to have that kind of resourcefulness. So the minute you bring that up for that child, you've robbed them of a small opportunity to experience what I call a successful failure.
So let's say, taking your example, your child has left not just homework, but a key paper on the table. And if that paper isn't turned in, they're not going to pass this class, or they're not going to get an A, which means that that'll be something that won't allow them to maybe get into the college they want. And you quickly amp up what's at stake here. What do you say then?
I'd bring that up. I'd bring that up to them at school. My co-founder of Challenge Success and I constantly disagree about this. She says you never bring it up because you
bring it up, meaning
bring it up to school.
Okay,
for the child who forgot it, she says you never bring it up. I say in line with you, if I left my notes for this interview at home and my husband saw it and said, "Oh, what the hell," I'd be pretty pissed off at him. So, you know, when in fact there's a great deal at stake, you're a family and you've got each other's back. But what parents think are at stake, a single homework assignment or they're missing their cleats from practice and the coach will be angry, that's really different than something critical.
So it's a question of calculation. I mean,
sure.
If there's a lot at risk, let's say you're talking with your 14-year-old about sexuality and you think that that child might be starting to engage in sexual practices, the stakes are higher than
sure.
a homework assignment. So there's time to engage and time not?
Well, I think you always engage.
Yeah.
I think you're always present. The question is whether you interfere. So the research is that the four most important factors in parenting are reliability, consistency, stability, and non-interference.
Hmm.
So if your child can do it or can almost do it.
What if you're good at just 3 out of 4?
Well, the reliability, stability, consistency, very few people argue with, right? You want your home to be pretty reliable and consistent and warm and stable and stuff like that. That's optimal. It's the non-interference that gets blowback. How can you not interfere? Just like you said, there's so much at stake. The whole point of what I'm talking about is to optimize your child. And I was on a panel a couple of weeks ago with the head engineer of NASA technology. So NASA, of course, had a great day yesterday. And he was talking about how impaired the kids that come as new hires to NASA are in terms of resilience, in terms of not having to come every hour. You know, it used to be a yearly report on their progress. Now they want to know every day how they're doing because they're so used to the outside. So the kinds of skills that practically every business leader says kids are going to need, resilience, creativity, the ability to get up again, innovative thinking, collaborative skills, huge one, collaborative skills, we're not investing in.
Madeline Levine is our guest. Her new book is Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. Subtitle, Why Values and Coping Skills Matter More Than Grades, Trophies, or Fat Envelopes. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take your calls as well. What are you struggling with as a parent? What are you struggling with if you're a young person listening to this? What is it that you'd like your parents to do or not do that currently is getting in the way, you think, of your own development? We'd like to talk more about both child development and parent development when we return. We'll take your calls at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your question, thought, concern on our Facebook page or on our website as well. We'll be back with more talking about how you teach your children the concept of authentic success when we return. Madeline Levine, our guest. 866-733-6786. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Madeline Levine is our guest this hour. Her new book, Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. We'd love to get your questions for Madeline Levine at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your thoughts, concerns, or questions on our website as well. Lots of calls and questions coming in, and some ones challenging your message, Madeline Levine. This first one from Cindy says, like it or not, our society has evolved where if you're in the top 1%, you win and you win big. If you're not, good luck. It's all nice and fuzzy to say, let's develop balanced kids, but the cold, hard reality is that balanced doesn't pay the bills.
So thank you, Cindy. It's a point that's been made many times. I think that what's really important to understand is that when I talk about soft skills or balance, I'm not talking about not learning the hard skills. Clearly, American kids need to learn the hard skills. We're not doing great at that, but it's in having a person who's capable of using their skills that you end up with a kid who can be successful in the world. So, you know, I treat a lot of kids. So, of course, I have a little bit of a skewed view, but I treat a lot of kids who end up in trouble because of the amount of pressure on them. And you can't be successful from a rehab bed. So if you look at the mental health numbers, the substance abuse numbers, the cutting numbers, something is off. And I think I'd like to, you know, clearly make the statement that I'm not talking about lowering standards. I'm talking about having kids be able to meet their greatest potential, and that we know from research that there are environments in which they do reach their greatest potential, and that's not when everything is being dictated to them externally.
And it sounds like you're also saying that those great hard skills that are important, mm-hmm. the ones that will get you into the good college or the good job, aren't really going to be put to use in the best way or make you happy in a full way if you don't have these other abilities.
Well, right. I mean, there's not a parent in the world who you say, what do you want for your child? And before pay the bills, and that's up there. I'm sympathetic with that. Like I said, I have three kids about to go out in the world. But the first answer is I want my kid happy. And so if, you know, you can push a kid, you can force a kid to sort of give up their childhood and their adolescence, but then you tend to end up with kids whose development is stunted.
Here's another question from someone who writes in. Steve writes in from Sacramento. Having just come back through from India and China, I find this discussion tone deaf. The extraordinary focus and energy that children are dedicating to their education in areas such as Delhi, Bangalore, and Shanghai is remarkable. 30 years ago, kids in our country were just competing against other American kids. Now they're competing against the world. The world is moving fast. You may not like it, but that doesn't change the reality.
Well, you're exactly right. It is moving fast. I think I had mentioned earlier having a discussion with the head engineer at NASA, at Goddard, and I'd like to communicate to you what he had to say about this exact issue. So they have essentially three groups of engineers, Asian engineers that they brought over from Asia, Indian engineers, and American engineers. And so I had this great opportunity to have a conversation with him about, you know, are we really falling behind? Are our kids not studying? Are they not doing well? And this was his answer. He said, in terms of hard skills, our kids are fine. It is around collaboration. It is around entitlement. It is around what you're sort of calling the soft skills that American kids are not doing well. And I think I'd like to really emphasize once again, yes, you want your child to work as hard as possible. We do have a lot of competition that, you know, there's no two ways around that. But in order for us to regain what was our edge all these years in America, it was innovation. And that's the edge we're losing. A friend of mine, Tim Kugel, who used to be the CEO of Yahoo, says, if we can keep the innovative edge, the creative edge, the collaborative edge, we can stay ahead. If we lose that, we are in big trouble. And I would agree with him.
Let's hear what our listeners are wondering about, questioning about, thinking about this morning on this topic. Michelle in San Francisco is first. Michelle, go ahead.
Hi. It's funny that this is playing today. I just read your editorial in the Times on Sunday. And then Monday, my six-year-old came home with a letter saying that his camp was going to go on a field trip today. And I was concerned about it. My friend, whose kid is also in the camp, was concerned about it because it's a bunch of teenagers running the camp, and they're not quite as on the ball as some of the other camps we've been to. And so for a second, we thought about not sending our kids. And then I thought about your article, and I told my friends, you know, we have to do this. Didn't you read the article? Like, we have to trust that our kids are going to come back to us. These teenagers have it under control. We've got to let them do this thing. So,
so how's it going?
You know, it's funny you ask, because I sent him on his way, and then I, I'm embarrassed to say this, I parked down the street and waited there for about half an hour to watch them all march past on the way to the BART station to see what, I don't know, to make sure he didn't get splattered in the street. And I felt sheepish doing it, but I didn't let him see me, and they're fine, and I'm sure that it's going to work out okay.
Michelle, thanks for the call.
Can I say something to Michelle?
Go ahead.
Michelle, you know, six is a young child, and I would be, you know, I'd be anxious about my young kid going off to camp as well. So I'm glad you read the article. And part of it is our capacity to tolerate our own anxiety when our kids go out in the world. And you just got a little taste of it. I suggest that you think about what that's going to be like when they get the keys for the first time and you have to let them drive down the road. So good for you.
Michelle, thanks. Let's hear next from Regina, who joins us in Los Gatos this morning. Regina, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much. I really appreciate all that you have said so far. The reliability, consistency, stability, and the non-interference are very key factors that I've been working with in my parenting efforts. And I'm a co-parent. I've got a five-year-old. She has been raised in two different homes. And my question is, how are we as co-parents to navigate that jurisdiction that's been pretty much levied by the courts in their 50-50 trend that they've maintained, even in the case of young children, in two different homes when you've got absolutely no control over what goes on in a different home? I'll just give you one brief example. I'm a no TV household, and we're big on the arts and music and dance and movement. And in the other home, there's screens in every room and multiple and big and flat, and she's got that on remote control in her own room. So the consistency piece, I'd really like to hear your thoughts.
Challenging question. Thanks, Regina.
You know, you raise, of course, because there are such a high rate of divorce, a really important issue. You know, you can only control the part of life that you have control over. And kids are actually pretty good at understanding that there are different circumstances in different homes. So, you know, often you'll say, the kid will say, in the other house, I'm allowed to watch TV. And really the answer is every house is different, and in this house we do it this way. But I don't want to underestimate the frustration of what it is when you feel you're sort of on the right track in terms of exposing kids to arts and limiting their exposure to television, and they spend half their time in a very different environment. But, you know, you get to control your own house.
Regina, thanks. Thanks for the call. Challenging question. And these are. I mean, I think it's also worth acknowledging that none of this is easy. They're tough things to sort your way through.
Right. And, you know, parents always want the best for their kids. So it's not like parents are trying to screw around with their kids' development. They're trying the best that they can in very trying economic times. So, it makes sense that people are going to be hypervigilant.
PV in San Jose. Go ahead.
Yes, a couple of comments. By the way, great show. I'm a parent of two kids, 14-year-old and a 10-year-old. And two comments. The first one is absolutely I agree with you on not overly encouraging the kids, number one. And number two, to let them fail, for them to understand what it is to fail and get up and walk again. But the question that I have, by the way, is what if we do just the opposite, meaning in cases where kids are not good in something, is it okay to go out and say, look, you're not good in this, either improve or figure out something else that you're good at?
Yeah,
I love that question because, PV, part of what I feel is that adults have this secret from kids. And the secret we have is that when you grow up, you only have to be really, really good at one or two things. And this idea of being good at everything, straight A's, you know, building water treatment plants in the Sudan and being the captain of the lacrosse team, is so unrealistic. So Dave and I are having a good time talking because we're verbal. I'm going to have trouble finding my way out of this building because my spatial skills are terrible. And so I didn't become a surgeon. And I think your point's an important one, that we spend so much time with tutors and, you know, worrying about a kid who has some difficulty in one field as opposed to concentrating on their strengths. Sure, you want to help your kid compensate for their weaknesses. But really, I think we ought to do more around building strengths, because the reality in life is you're good at a couple things, you're average at most things, and you know, you're pretty miserable at one or two.
So how blunt should parents be in a situation like PV describes? Let's say your child is playing softball and really isn't very good about it. Should you as a parent say, you know, you're not very good about that. Why don't you try the piano?
No, I wouldn't. That's your child's call. So I think you sort of hang out with your kid and encourage them to talk about their experience. There were kids, three boys, a lot of athletics, who were on their teams, and they stayed on year after year, and they were absolutely non-athletic, but they liked being part of the team, and they were at home and felt totally comfortable.
But what wouldn't be a service would be to say to that not very good softball playing daughter of yours, you are so great.
Right. That would be unrealistic.
Here's a question from a teacher. Stephanie writes in, I've been a middle school teacher at an expensive elite private school in the Bay Area for 10 years, and my colleagues and I have witnessed a steady increase in the rise of helicopter parents, loving, well-meaning, anxious parents with resources who often interfere with the natural relationship between a child and their teachers and the natural consequences of their choices. I believe that that's to the child's detriment. Do parents get in the way then of what can develop at school?
You know, I think shout out to you, Stephanie, for being a teacher. I think it's the hardest job in the world. And I think our teachers don't get anywhere near the acclaim and salaries that they should, having been a teacher in my former life. So, yes, I think that especially in very affluent schools, sometimes teachers are kind of treated like the help. And I think a kid's relationship with a teacher is one of the most salutary things a child can have. You know, parents sometimes feel nobody else is going to do as good a job as they are. But in fact, it's the other adult. If your child has a relationship with another adult, that is critical. Each one of my boys had somebody in their life, a coach, a teacher.
And you point out at one point in the book that your kids' friends would sort of listen to you more than your kids would.
Oh, of course.
Having that other adult connection is important.
Right.
Say something, if you would, too, about the role of fathers in this. You touch on this a couple of times, but this is a conversation that often becomes more about mothers and children. And you point out a number of times how important that other relationship is.
Right. I did. And I had to work long and hard because the research just isn't there. The research is on moms. We have 60 years of research on mothers. Fathers are incredibly important in terms of bringing their kids out into the world, of making sure the home is not chaotic. You know, I've had dads who come to me because they can't get off their BlackBerry. And you got to get off your BlackBerry because you're not present if you're on it all the time. And that's very hard for a lot of dads. So, you know, there are a couple of areas like body image where we know that fathers are particularly important. Values, we know fathers are particularly important. So bringing them into the conversation is really important, and bringing them into some research is also important.
Julie in Palo Alto. Julie, go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I want to disclose that I'm on the board of Challenge Success. I know Madeline. I'm a big fan, and you guys are putting on a great show today. My question is this. Madeline, I know you care deeply about the importance of kids having that unstructured free time and, you know, to build creativity and to try and fail and become more self-reliant. My question is, in communities such as ours, where there's tremendous peer pressure, I think, from parents toward other parents, what do we do if we're in a community where nobody wants their kids to be biking outside, quote-unquote, alone? Do you have a sense of communities where parents are banding together to say, hey, we support our kids having a lot of free, unstructured time after school. We support that kind of activity over those structured enrichment activities. Do you have examples, I guess, is what I'm saying, of places where parents are getting it right?
Hey, Julie, how are you?
You
bring up a point that's so important, which is the amount of peer pressure that parents have in their own communities. Part of what I think is that we have a very short-term view of success, where we should have our eye on the ball 30 years down the line when our kids are actually going out into the world and becoming parents and mates and things like that. So what I'm going to use your question for, Julie, is to make a case for the fact that since we know unstructured time is critical, and yes, indeed, there are communities, you know, the free range movement and Jeff Snipes' school, Montessori, land-based Montessori school in Marin. There are definitely communities that are putting these kinds of things first, and that parents have to, you know, I come from a testosterone-laced household, man up to the fact that their kids are being endangered. They're losing their childhood with all the things around resilience that that builds. And so when my kids were younger and they sprayed Alar on the apples at Safeway, we were out with picket signs, every one of us, and, you know, toxic apples. And now we're talking about an environment that has known toxicity, right? You take away play and you increase the chance that your kid's going to end up in prison. So it's time, I think, for more mothers, because I'm a mom and that's who I treat, to get together, and fathers, obviously, and say enough, you know.
Enough of what? Is it too much homework? Is it, what are the specifics that you think parents ought to sort of take action on and carry those picket signs forward?
Okay, so the first one would be homework. That homework that's assigned in schools is so out of line with the meta-analysis of what amount of homework's needed. 10 minutes per grade in elementary school, 1 hour in junior high school, two and a half hours in high school. And there are plenty of junior high school kids that are doing 3 hours. We know there's no academic or cognitive benefit to it.
So, how do we tell me what we know about that? I mean, because this is something that will strike a lot of parents as being really surprising. You're saying that an hour of homework a night when you're in the fourth grade is too much? And what sort of effect does that have?
Okay, so what the research shows is that you derive cognitive benefits from a certain amount of work, right? And then there's a big drop-off. So if you're in the fourth grade, and I'd rather not use elementary school. I'd rather use
junior high, fine.
Because that's where things start getting really crazy. There's a drop-off in the capacity to learn. Because kids are getting less sleep, there's a drop-off in the transfer of memory from short-term to long-term memory. There's a drop-off in concentration. Yeah. They're not learning. They may be able to perform, but here in California, our top 12% that go to the UCs and state schools, half of them have to take remedial English or math. These are our brightest kids. How come they're taking remedial? Because they really never learned it. Their learning's, you know, a mile long and an inch deep.
So they've learned how to perform on the tests that are required, but they haven't really fully mastered particular skills.
Correct.
And conversely, you've said a couple of times how important, and our caller did as well, unstructured and play time is. What does that give you that homework doesn't?
So I always have the image of my boys running around playing chase outside, and right, it looked like a bunch of wild Indians basically when they were young. But if you think about something as simple as chase, which looks like nothing is happening. In fact, think of the social, first of all, it's physical activity in a nation full of having an obesity crisis, so that's good. But also think about the social transaction that you have a chaser and a chasee, and you have to negotiate who is who. And if one of them stops, then the game is over. And who's the leader? Who's the follower? I mean, there's a million things happening, and it's happening internally. Nobody is saying you are much better at following. You are much better at leading. The kids are figuring that out in their interaction.
Teresa in Castro Valley, go ahead with your question, please.
Hi. Hi. I have 2 points I wanted to make. One is I wanted to comment on the woman who was clandestinely watching the teenager take her six-year-old. And I just wanted to clarify, I don't think that you're saying that unstructured means unsupervised.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, and I think as mothers and parents, you know, we know intuitively how much to kind of watch over our children, and I think it's critical. I mean, as a high school teacher, I see a lot of parents who've told me, you know, they're 14, I just can't watch them anymore. And that's when they need to be watched perhaps the most closely in terms of social things.
I would agree with you on that. And no, it's not about not watching our children. I mean, our first job, our absolute first job is to keep our children safe, right? Nothing else matters. Nothing I'm talking about matters if our children are unsafe, if they're running across the street or falling off a playground structure that's too tough for them. So that's our first order of business. And then everything else I'm saying comes after that.
The distinction is you want people to pay attention. You just don't want them to sort of step in.
That's right. I keep saying I want them present, but not interfering.
Teresa, was there something else you wanted to say?
Yeah, and I just wanted to say one more thing about the whole resilience issue when I was raising my daughters. I never was like a helicopter mom who chose their teachers or that kind of thing, because I didn't want to imply to my children that they weren't flexible, that unless they had a perfect situation or perfect from my perspective, that they couldn't somehow learn to navigate it. And so when you are always second-guessing for your children, it implies to them that they're so weak and that they can't handle disappointment sometimes. So I would totally agree with your speaker that we need to let our kids sometimes have things come up that are difficult. That's not to say if something's really not right, then you step in.
Teresa, thanks.
Yeah, they learn so much from that.
Right.
Here's an interesting question from Susan, who writes in on the web. I was one of those children who grew up with parents telling me how wonderful I was, but who wound up having very low self-esteem and continues to have that. So what do you recommend for adults who still are working on that issue?
I assume you're saying that part of that is because you didn't get to measure up internally to whatever it was you thought your parents wanted. And I think for young people that feel that way, the part of the answer, you know, if it's really debilitating, obviously, is to get some treatment around it. It's not a particularly difficult issue, and somebody could be really helpful to you. But the other thing is to emotionally learn to separate yourself from those messages that you got as a kid, and to spend, you know, think of yourself as a few years younger in this particular arena, and spend the time thinking about who you are, what you want in life, what your goals are, what matters to you, and see if you can get a little bit of emotional separation from that internalized image that you have that was your parents and not yours.
There's another question emailed in who writes in. Interesting question. Good morning. Do you have any advice for parents who have kids who have a hard time learning from their mistakes? So sounds like a parent who's letting their child make mistakes, but the kid isn't learning from that.
You know, kids have different rates of learning from their mistakes. So, you know, one kid learns after being stopped once for speeding, and some kids need multiple, speeding tickets and the car taken away from them and their privilege taken away before they learn. I think that barring any, you know, real psychological issue, you have to understand that kids come with a temperament, and temperament really doesn't change over life. So the kid who is more of a risk taker is always going to be more of a risk taker. The kid who learns quickly is always going to learn quickly. And if you have a child, just bear in mind that we used to think that brain development was done at about 20 or 21, and now we know it's done at about 27 or 28. So it does take kids quite a while to learn from their mistakes.
You have this great image at one point in the book that a brain for a 12-year-old is sort of like putting a 12-year-old behind the wheel of a Ferrari.
Right. So no brakes.
Right. Laura in Gualala joins us next. Laura, just a quick question if you would. We're a bit short on time. Laura, are you with us?
There, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay, I was of the generation that you know, and I was privileged, so they threw me out to the wolves, but we never would have thought of going back home. And my brother, on the other hand, has raised his kids to be little gods, and and they had a hard time when they went to college because none of their peers thought of them as special little gods. And so now one of them has moved back in, and now she's independent. She's been away at college, and she's completely taken over the house and makes my brother feel terrible. And if he tries to criticize her in any way, like help with the dishes or help clean up your room, you're living in the house, she pulls, oh, I'm manic, oh, I'm ADD, I can't cope, you're going to drive me to suicide kind of thing. So what do you do when you've raised these special little beings that don't have the resilience and still provide the stability that you've always provided for them and yet let them learn from hard knocks?
Laura,
I'll
thanks.
Take my call at the
yeah,
end.
And I'm afraid we just have a moment for a very hard question.
You know, that's a really tough question. Kids who threaten suicide need to be taken seriously. You know, yes, it may be a manipulation, but I never blow that off. And he's got to set different rules around the house. I mean, if you've made a mistake and you realize it, you have to insist on chores and insist that kids should always be contributing members to the community and the family is their first community.
Not fair to ask you this when we just have 30 seconds left, but it was a favorite point that you made. And I just want to ask you to comment on why you think it's worth thinking about, which is you raised the question, would you rather have your kid be good or smart?
Yeah, it's a tough question, right? And it's really at the heart of things. You know, it's the first time in history where parents would rather have their children diagnosed than hear their average, right? You go from psychologist to psychologist to get a learning disability diagnosis rather than just say, you know, you got a great kid and they're average. And I think it's really critical that we dig down and think about that question in a real way.
And you got a great call about that once to one of your kids, right? From a calculus teacher.
I did, from a class that my son was not doing well in. And it was just, I want to tell you what a great kid you have. And it was the best call ever in my life.
Madeline Levine. The book is Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. And I should mention, but I'm afraid I've buried it somewhere. Oh, here it is. She will be at the Great Good Place for Books at Oakland, 7 o'clock on Thursday night. And then Thursday, August the 23rd, she'll be at Books, Inc. in San Francisco, both at 7 o'clock. August 9th in Oakland, August the 23rd in San Francisco. Madeline Levine, thanks for being with us this
Pleasure.
Morning. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Tina Lorberg. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.